From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from researchers with Advocate Aurora Health, who are trying to tackle the lack of diversity in clinical research.
It's so critical to have people enrolled in these studies who are going to be benefactors of the results.
Then we'll learn about the King Center on Milwaukee's Near North Side. Plus, look at the history of landmark lanes and how it continues to meet the shifting preferences of Milwaukeeans.
The landmark, in many ways, is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's not even just one bar, it's three bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start today with Capital Notes. WUWM's Chuck Quernbach is standing in for Mayan Silver this week. He checks in with WisPolitics' J.R. Ross to talk about the lengthy legal battle ahead after Act 10 was struck down by a judge, and the chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin's bid to become the chair of the DNC.
From Milwaukee's NPR, this is Capital Notes. We break down the big political news affecting Wisconsin. I'm Chuck Quernbach, filling in for Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WisPolitics.com. Here's our latest conversation. Hi, J.R. Welcome to the Act 10 has been ruled upon. What's next edition of Capital Notes?
Okay, great. Good to be here.
So again, last week, a Dane County judge basically threw out quite a bit or all of the Act 10 law restricting public sector bargaining in Wisconsin. Republicans have appealed the circuit court ruling. What do we know about what's coming up next for this?
Well, probably a lengthy appeals process. And the question becomes, when might the state Supreme Court hear it? And who on the court would hear that case? So first, let's back up. Judge Jacob Frost at Dane County struck down dozens of provisions in Act 10. Not everything that the unions had asked him to remove, but the vast majority. And the basic effect is it restores collective bargaining powers for most of the employees who lost them back in 2011. Now, almost immediately, Republican lawmakers went to the Second District Court of Appeals. It's based in Waukesha. There are four judges on that court. Three are conservatives. You get a three-judge panel to hear a case, it guarantees Republicans they're going to have a conservative majority for that appeal. It's their go-to court these days when they want to appeal something out of Dane County. Now, the option for the unions, though, is to ask the Supreme Court to take the appeal directly. They can do what's called a petition to bypass. Essentially argue, this case is so important, let's not waste time with these three judges hearing it. Let's go right to the top court in Wisconsin. So, one, you know, will anybody make that move? Two, would the Supreme Court agree to it? Then three, who's going to hear it?
Why wouldn't the entire state Supreme Court hear this case?
Well, Janet Protasiewicz, when she ran, she said she might, and I stress the word might, not hear an Act 10 suit because she signed a recall petition and protested the law. You have Brian Hagedorn, who is a conservative member of the court. He was part of the Walker administration that, you know, drafted Act 10 and put it into effect. So does he have a conflict of interest? Like, the rules of Wisconsin basically say it's up to each judge or justice to decide if they have a conflict. Now, there are standards that say you should recuse if A, B, and C, but ultimately it's for the judges to decide. I have yet to meet a judge or talk to one who said, you know what, I really can't be impartial. You know, I'm compromised. They think of themselves as being people who could hear a case fairly, right? That's human nature. So I don't know what they will do when push comes to shove. I have seen justices step aside of cases if there's like a personal connection, like, you know, their relative works the law firm, it's before the, you know, something like that. But it's a big question of who might hear it if it comes up soon. And then two, we've got a race in the spring. Ann Walsh Bradley, a liberal, is not seeking reelection. You know, the Supreme Court usually I stress, hears oral arguments to like late spring-ish. If they don't get it by then, it would go the next term, which begins August 1st. And so the new justice, whoever wins that race in April, we expect it now to be Brad Schimmel, conservative, and Susan Crawford, liberal. they might be on the court, and how will that affect things? Would the balance change? Right now, it's a 4-3 liberal majority. Could it go back to conservatives if Schimmel were to win? So lots of what-ifs right now are question marks about the appeal process, but we're nowhere near a final decision in this issue.
I was going to say, I'm thinking of the union members with whom I spoke, or you probably spoke as well, excited about this Dane County court ruling, but, you know, some guarded optimism as to when they might see what they think is more fair bargaining, and we don't know.
No, and the other question is, what will the rules be? What's it going to look like? I mean, remember, there were these contracts in place previously. A lot of them weren't renewed before Democrats lost control of the state capitol in 2010. That opened the door to Walker and Republicans doing Act 10 because there weren't contracts in place. So do you start from square one with these contracts? So, if, you know, you're bargaining for everything. Do you try and, like, use the last one you had as a benchmark? There's lots of, like, things up in the air, but the House process is going to work if this ruling stands.
Okay, well, we'll watch for that. Meanwhile, someone who has been sort of one of the architects for the Democrats' challenges to Act 10, challenges to conservative control of the state Supreme Court, architect of legislative redistricting, maybe some other things, Ben Wickler of the State Democratic Party is running for the national DNC chair. And again, that contest is not for 6-8 weeks. But what does Wickler have going for him, first of all?
Well, he's got endorsements from kind of across the spectrum right now. There's a group called the PCCC. I think I got the right number of C's in there. They're a progressive group. They're endorsing Wickler. There's it's called the Third Way. It's more of a moderate Democratic group. He's got a lot of people who are from Wisconsin who are saying, hey, this guy's been great. But really, you know, this race is a 450-person committee made up of national committee members. These are like the ultimate insiders, elected officials, state party chairs, state party vice chairs, committee members from each state. Like, it's, somebody described it to me as the world's smallest city council race. What the person meant by that was you've got this very kind of select group of people who are voting for it. It's not like a statewide campaign, or it is like glad handing like all of these folks. And he's got competition. The state chair in Minnesota says he's got endorsements of 200 people already, 200 members of the committee. There are others who are still looking at it. So we're a ways away from kind of knowing what the field looks like for sure. And then two, you know, where he is in the pecking order. But there are definitely some people who think that Wickler is what Democrats need nationally, because he's what he's built in Wisconsin.
But where has he fallen short? It's obvious that Kamala Harris did not win Wisconsin in November. Legislative control did not go to the Democrats quite yet. He's got a ways to go on that. Where has Mr. Wickler not quite delivered everything that he might want in Wisconsin?
Well, it shows that money doesn't fix everything. Wickler's been a phenomenal fundraiser, but money doesn't top environment. And it was definitely a pro-Trump environment in November. So, you know, Wickler and his defenders will point to the fact that the nation shifted by like 6 points toward Trump in 24 from 2020. Wisconsin, however, saw a shift of 1.5 percentage points. That's in like one of the ultimate swing states. So they will argue, his backers, that, hey, here's a guy who helped engineer this turnout operation Wisconsin that blunted the effect of the Trump wave, as some people have called it. But, you know, the chair from Minnesota who's running, he said, look, Ben's not winning everything. You know, he's kind of like a little dig at him about that because, you know, Harris didn't win Wisconsin, because Mandela Barnes didn't win the Senate race in 2022 against Ron Johnson. I don't know that from my conversations that's necessarily Ben Wickler's fault. But a guy like the Minnesota is going, hey, we keep winning over here in Minnesota and we've won more than they have in Wisconsin. Maybe I've got something that he doesn't. So we'll see how that kind of plays out and how the National Committee members feel about the record of Ben Wickler in Wisconsin.
Would it make a difference to the average Wisconsinite if Wickler becomes the national DNC chair? Or is this sort of inside politics?
Oh, if you can walk down Water Street some Friday night and find me 25 people know Ben Wickler by first name, I'll be impressed. And I don't mean to be flippant about that, but this is the ultimate insider conversation, right? Because here's a state party chair. He's not an elected official. He's really known to insiders, but it's an insider crowd that is going to decide this race for DNC chair. For Wisconsinites, it's not going to change anything in their daily lives, other than for state Democrats, if Wickler leaves, they've got to figure out how can they keep the money train rolling that he's built at the state party, because that money train has helped fund a lot of the successes they've seen, like Tony Evers winning re-election in 2022, like Democrats picking up seats in the legislature, especially in the Senate, the state Senate this past fall, despite a not great environment for them. Like, Wickler has been a rainmaker when it comes to money, and that money funds the train that, you know, fueled their wins. So who do you find to replace him to help in that regard?
Partisan control of things like the governor's office and legislature do affect the people of Wisconsin.
Absolutely. That's my point, that he's more the behind-the-scenes guy to what you see at the ballot box. And that's going to be big, because we look at the Supreme Court race in the spring. The state Democratic Party like gave Protasiewicz $10 million in 2023, roughly. We expect the 2025 race to be as expensive, if not more, than the 2023 one, which I tracked $56 million plus in spending in that race overall. It will probably top that because control of the court's up once again. It's at stake. So there's a lot of stuff going on financially. And Republicans I talked to hope Wickler leaves now. They would like him to be out the door as soon as possible to try to cut off that gravy train of money and make it more of a fair fight in their minds going forward. There's no denying that Wickler has done a better job building that financial operation than Republicans have. And look, you know, Ben's got a perfect storm. He's got national contacts from his time at MoveOn.org, this big national progressive group. He's in a swing state, which is perpetually in the eye of the storm for state and federal elections. And he's got Tony Evers in the governor's office. It's just, you ask anybody in politics, it's easier to raise money when you have the governor's office. And Evers and Wickler have been a great team together. But it's a perfect storm. Like, somebody told me one time, if Ben Wickler were the chair of the North Dakota Democratic Party, nobody knew who he was. But he's got the right environment with the right background to be a success. Republicans, however, have not been able to match that operation. There are millionaires all over this country, and Democrats have figured out a way to get them to invest in Wisconsin. Republicans have really not been as good at that. And even Wickler leaving is not going to fix that problem for Republicans, but how you get out-of-state donors to invest in the state, which is so important at so many levels.
Well, thanks, JR. Who says early December is a quiet time in politics?
Never. There's always something going on.
That was J.R. Ross of WisPolitics.com speaking with me, WUWM's Chuck Quernbach. Check out the Capital Notes podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
That'll be the last Capital Notes of the year. But be sure to tune in on Wednesday when Ben Wickler will join us here on Lake Effect. In medical research, clinical trials are how new treatments, drugs, or surgeries get tested. They're how researchers figure out whether treatments work and whether they're safe and effective. But nationwide, clinical trials have a diversity problem. People of color are often underrepresented. It means that what researchers learn doesn't apply to as many people as it should. That can perpetuate poor health outcomes. Researchers from Advocate Aurora Research Institute checked on the health system's own clinical trials. As a part of the study, the researchers sat down with Black, Hispanic, and Asian community members to hear how they think diversity in these trials can be improved. Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick is a research scientist who led the study, and Osandi Ozani-Lohr is a senior research associate who helped with the community interviews. They joined WUWM's Lena Tran to share what they learned.
The study was funded by the Advocate Charitable Foundation. So they gave us money to sort of look at the equity in our COVID clinical trials. And so through this, we were sort of like, well, if we're going to look at just our COVID clinical trials, which there were only like half a dozen, and Advocate Aurora runs like 80 to 120 clinical trials. So our COVID clinical trials were not a very large, you know, section of our portfolio. We sort of were like, okay, if we want to look at the equity in clinical trials, in our COVID clinical trials, why don't we look at the equity in all of our clinical trials? And then why don't we look at how representative this is of our health system or our clinics or the area? And so we sort of took our funding and tried to answer bigger questions with it.
Just to back up, this is going to sound maybe really obvious, but why is it important that your clinical trials are representative of the community that you're serving?
Science and clinical trials in general is a fundamental kind of subject where if our trials are not equitable or if it doesn't show enough diversity, those results get perpetuated. And it creates, you know, kind of bias, too. It creates a situation where a certain group of people are not, they don't get access to innovative healthcare. And it creates health outcomes disparity. If we have a study in that sense that's lacking diversity, it gets perpetuated. So somebody else would pick that study and, you know, make it a building block of their study. So solving that problem at its initial stage is very important.
It's not everyone is white men.
Exactly. Groundbreaking observation.
Yeah, exactly.
Not everyone is white men.
My research actually is mostly in care delivery and prenatal care. As we're seeing across this country, there's a really, really big issue with Black women in particular having, you know, maternal, and their baby outcomes are just not embarrassingly poor in this country. And that's not anything that has to do with our healthcare system in general. That's just like across the board. It's just, it's so critical to have people enrolled in these studies who are going to be benefactors of the results.
Are there examples of medications or treatments that historically, like, their effectiveness was shaped by race or gender, and people realize, like, oh, it's because we just weren't assessing how well they work on all the right people?
I think heart disease is a really good example of that. I think that generally it was thought, I mean, because all clinical trials for heart disease were in white men, you know, and the way heart disease looks in women is very, very, very different than men. And the drugs and the treatments weren't as effective in women. And so finally, they were like, wait a minute, maybe we should include women in clinical trials. And it turns out that it was totally different.
So you set out to do this inventory. What are the trends that you find?
So we found that the people most likely to participate in clinical trials are white women over the age of 65. We also found that people of color are not as well represented in clinical trials. And so we set out to create like this environment where we could talk to the people in the community that we serve and see what the barriers are, what's preventing them from participating in clinical trials, and what solutions that they think that we could apply and make them participate more in clinical trials.
So what kinds of things did you hear from them?
I think the most interesting thing was when we started to conduct the interviews, trust was one of the things that was just in the back of my mind, because we all have that little bias in our heads. But what we found it was trust was a byproduct of the need for more knowledge about clinical trials, more of a presence in the community. If the people that we are trying to approach about clinical trials don't understand clinical trials because they haven't been exposed enough, or they don't know us as well, it's difficult for them to participate and trust us enough to participate in clinical trials.
I think there's a lot of mistrust among communities of color when it comes to any sort of experimental medicine, right? Very, very well-founded sort of lack of trust. And I think to Asandi's point, you know, not all clinical trials look the same, right? Like, some are experimental devices and drugs, and some are just, you know, an app on your phone. And so I think there's a misunderstanding that, you know, everything is this sort of, you know, take this drug that we've never tested, or try this thing in your heart that we've never done before, when a lot of clinical trials are not that. You know, the lack of knowledge about the depth and breadth and what they entail and how they are considered legitimate treatments, I think, was one thing that sort of rose to the top, was not so much that people wouldn't participate, and not so much that people wouldn't participate despite not trusting the healthcare system, was just that they didn't know much about them. They didn't know anything about them until they were sick. You know, they didn't know where to even find clinical trials. They didn't know how to get more information about clinical trials. You know, and that was one of the things where we were like, oh, okay, so what can we do as a healthcare system to better educate the community so they wouldn't pass up this opportunity to be part of a potentially innovative treatment?
Yeah. How did it feel as someone who's, as a health professional, as a researcher, to hear some of those things?
There is an understanding to it. You know, one participant actually said, you know, when there is a study or a clinical trial going on, they see us. They feel that presence in the community. We're there recruiting. We're there talking to them about the study. But then when that trial or that study is over, we're gone. Because then we retreat back to do our analysis and our writing. But what we've done is we've created a relationship and a connection, and then we just kind of stop. And so I can understand that. And it's really important to have a constant connection with the people that we are serving or presenting this clinical trials to. So it's not a case of, oh, we just need you for now and we don't need you anymore.
What do you think it would look like to shift that relationship?
You know, we got so many solutions from our community members and even our clinical trial staff. And one of the things that we got out of it was creating a presence, creating some kind of connection. First of all, just having a sit down with them and listening to them.
Mm-hmm. I've been a health disparities researcher for over a decade, so I'm certainly not surprised when vulnerable populations, that could look like anything. That could be people of color, that could be lower income people, that could be people who do not speak English as a primary language. I mean, anybody who's really at a disadvantage in our super highly literate healthcare system. Sandy, I think you said it super well, which is like as researchers, we take from our communities and sometimes forget to give it back. And we, you know, what are the dissemination products of research? It's manuscripts, it's, you know, peer-reviewed papers, it's, you know, presentations at medical conferences, and that is not where the community is. Right. And those are not things that the community understands. And so I think it's really on us, and we're lucky because we work in a healthcare system, so we can actually show what the results are and we can actually make changes in our healthcare system. But I think that's, you know, people's interview time and people's opinions means a lot to them. And to just take them and not give it back to the community, I think doesn't close that loop. And we're really, really trying to close that loop.
This is really interesting because people talk about this in journalism, too. How can we not be extractive and take people's stories and say, like, bye, never see you again? Yeah. And how can it be, like, more symbiotic?
Mm-hmm. That's so funny because you're totally right. It's the exact same thing because it's like these are who these people are. Like, what they're giving us, the vulnerability that they're allowing us to share in is something that, you know, ends up being, you know, a line in a paper when it's not.
It's their life.
Experiences in life, yeah. And it's just we have direct interactions with the people that we're taking, you know, this data and their experiences from. And so we take it very seriously to try to do something with it. It's not just for funding. It's to take the lessons learned and try to implement them as best as we can.
Going back to the listening sessions, I'm wondering if either of you have a memorable moment. Was there a breakthrough or something that really surprised you?
I was kind of surprised by how many people were willing to participate in clinical trials. It's a lot of interactions with the healthcare system. It's you have to drive there, you have to sit there, you have to have some sort of treatment schedule. But I don't think there was a single person that we talked to who was like, no way.
Right.
I would never do that. Mm-hmm. Most people were like, yeah, okay. And we talked to old people. We talked to young people. We talked to almost everybody identified as a person of color. That was one of our inclusion criteria. But, I was really surprised by that. Because even myself, I'd be like,
Right.
A lot of work. I don't know. Yeah. But really, people were pretty enthusiastic. And again, even though people were like, I don't totally trust the healthcare system, they were still willing to participate. And I was just like, says a lot there's this misconception that people of color don't want to interact with the healthcare system, and that is not true based on the people we interviewed,
which is like a scientist's dream, right? There's this whole pool of data, but you've just got to bridge the gap. You know,
totally.
They're willing to share it.
I think we make as researchers, as you know, predominantly white people, I think we make a lot of assumptions about how people feel. You know, and it's not until we go into the community and ask these questions directly where we can really fight those assumptions. And I think a lot of people assume, like, well, if you don't trust the healthcare system, then you're not going to participate in a clinical trial. And the community was loud and clear. They're like, we are happy to participate in a clinical trial. We literally don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And that's that point with that implicit bias, you know, because we already think in our heads, oh, you know, they don't want to, and maybe that's why we don't have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Veronica, there was this op-ed where you mentioned that Advocate Aurora has been using the past year to see how some of these suggestions could be folded in. I'm wondering if there's any more specifics that you can share on what that's looked like.
Yeah, we formed three sort of steering committees. One of them is focused on the community and sort of how, to Lasandi's point, how we can actually meaningfully, you know, integrate into the community. And a lot of that is partnering with our community health department. The second part of it is working on our translational services, because one of the things that also came out in our data was that there was definitely disparity when it came to Black people, but there was also a lot of disparity in people who do not speak English as a primary language. So people who identified as Hispanic and actually people who identified as Asian. And then the third part of it was how we can better use our medical record system to screen people. So one of the things that we found out in the results was that it was really hard to figure out who was being approached for clinical trials. We knew who was being consented, but you have to say yes at that point to be consented. So we've now integrated something into our medical record system where we can actually really easily document who is screened to see if there's disparity in who's being approached, which is where implicit bias would totally show up. One of the things that we're trying to do is that we tend to like lump groups together. Like we tend to be like Hispanic, and like there's a very big difference between, say, Puerto Rican and Mexican, or we do Asian, and there's a very big difference between, you know, Japanese or Chinese or, you know, like Laotian, you know, and also different likelihood of speaking English as a primary language. So I would love in the future to figure out how to like differentiate these subgroups, because I think it's going to be very telling. But that said, we're working with our translational team to try to figure out how to like just better be prepared for people who might need to be consented, allowing their families to be there for support and stuff like that. And then, like I said, we're trying to integrate more meaningfully into the community.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Veronica and Lasandi, thank you so much for joining me on Lake Effect and talking about your work.
Thank you for having us.
That was WUWM's Lena Tran, speaking with Dr. Veronica Fitzpatrick and Lasandi Ozani-Lohr from Advocate Aurora Research Institute. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Landmark Lanes has been around for almost 100 years on the East Side. Later in the show, we'll learn about the history of the Milwaukee Institution. But first, we'll learn about the King Center on Milwaukee's near north side. That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. The King Center has been serving the near north side of Milwaukee for more than 45 years. Over time, it has been home to countless summer camps, youth programs, and community groups. The park even once featured a roller rink, outdoor theater, and sports courts and fields of all kinds. This summer, during the Republican National Convention, police shot and killed Sam Sharp Jr. right in front of the building. A center that brought people together was then portrayed as a problematic place to avoid. But for the people who really know this place, they know that's not the full story. Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez shares this portrait of the King Center.
When I was a kid, and then this was my favorite room in the building. It's all crazy in there now, but...
Yeah, they're doing a whole bunch of renovation
in
there.
Yeah, that was Miss Ramona's room. That was the art room, and I spent so much of my time in there.
214?
Yep, that was my favorite space.
This is Symphony Swan Zawadi, and we are at the King Center on the near north side. Symphony used to come here just about every summer growing up.
I don't know if we got into what you do today, but...
Yeah, so today I'm literally an artist, a practicing artist, so it makes sense. I work for a National Arts Foundation, and I've been an art teacher. I've been a community artist. It is in my blood, and I had opportunities here at the King Center to express that and explore that.
All right, so Symphony might be humble, but I'm going to speak for her, and I do not have to be. She is one of one in Milwaukee. Last year, Shepherd Express named her Milwaukeean of the Year. She's won grant funding for her art. She has started and led arts organization in the city. And she says that none of that happens without the King Center. The place Mr. Holmes pushed her to compete in track, where she eventually became a city conference champ. It's where she hooped with the boys, a place where even when she was home, she always begged to go back.
Like, can we go to the King Center? You know, you had your little summertime crushes, you had your friends, you know. And that was just, it felt like family every time we were here.
No community center is just its building. Not the good ones anyways. But the King Center, it's a part of Milwaukee's history. A part of the fabric of the story of our city, and particularly Black Milwaukee.
We are being remodeled. We're getting a brand new roof, getting a lot of knockouts of some walls to enlarge the rooms and eliminate some overhangs. I am Dee McCollum, the director of the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Community Center.
Dee McCollum, or just Ms. Dee, as everyone calls her, says the renovations are long overdue. She painted the whole main floor in a high-gloss white with black trim, saying that she wants it to look bright, just how she hopes people feel when they come inside. How are you thinking about the space and community specifically and bringing people into the space?
One of the things that I do on purpose is when we have our 4th of July celebration, our Thanksgiving celebration, and our Christmas celebration, I on purpose give them the programming information for what's going on in the King Center every day. And what I've noticed over the years, what happens from that is a lot of those people have never been here before. They just come for the Christmas celebration or the Thanksgiving. But now I've given them some information about what we do the other 364 days of the year. And we now have those people funneling back into the building.
Ms. Dee says there are rooms to rent for events like birthday parties, corporate events, or luncheons. They also house a bunch of community partners like Fathers Making Progress and Summit, which works in youth programming. There's a new partner that'll help folks transition from foster care. There's the basketball court, which stays full, a legendary boxing gym and karate program, and a basketball literacy program soon to start, led by Milwaukee's own Mike Taylor. Yeah, the same one who put up 35 against the Knicks at Madison Square Garden.
Boy, he is quick, kicking up his heels.
Taylor to the basket, left hand up and in.
Wow. But even with all the renovations happening around here, people are still coming in. And that includes to use the full circuit gym downstairs. Think Planet Fitness, but without the purple. And that's where Enrique was working out his delts and traps.
I waited until the ripe age of 60 to start bodybuilding. And I'm focusing on creating the image I have within, making it real. I just have a lot of history here. I started coming here when I was a kid. I must have been about 11 or 12. I played pool. In fact, I used to practice piano in one of the rooms. Back in the day, there was Mr. Pitts was the director. And I would come and I would do arts and crafts. And it was just, you know, this was the place to be.
If you're from Milwaukee, you might not have heard of this gym, but you probably heard of the other one here, the legendary Al Moreland's Boxing Gym. The gym here isn't too big. There's a ring that's got a few elementary age kids in it right now swinging wildly. There are a few heavy bags and lockers lining the room. And in the back, there's a smaller space with some free weights and treadmills. And it may look modest, but this is where some of Milwaukee's baddest champs have come from.
So I'm doing a little story on the King Center and just like what this place means to the community, to folks. Obviously having a boxing program here.
You want to go up in the office right quick? I mean, in a little area?
This is Ernie Haynes. His mirrored lens glasses say he's no nonsense. Probably why he's the center's lead boxing trainer. And it's a position he took over after the late Al Moreland's brother Tom called him after COVID lockdown.
He says, Ernie, can you carry on? And I told him it'd be my honor to carry on the Moreland legacy and to bring in the team certified legacy and, you know, my legacy as well.
Ernie has trained professional boxers. He loves training pro fighters. But his calling was to train kids, specifically kids being bullied. He's talked about this with his own son being bullied. And after a while, it was just time to teach him how to defend himself. And now this is something he does for all kids.
This is where my wealth lies. Wealth has nothing to do with the money. It has everything to do with what you leave behind, your legacy. So that's where I'm at right now.
All right, we can't leave the King Center without talking about the other gym, the one where the Hoopers live.
My name is Charles Dupree. I've been a member of the King Center for the time it opened. There were great players coming through here, like Marquette. They had Marquette players. They had some of the Bucks. A lot of great pickup games.
Was there trash talking, or was it like friendly, kind of like, I don't know what friendly looks like there?
Of course, there's always trash talking. That's what makes the game so competitive.
Were you more of a trash talker, or were you more of like a silent killer?
Pretty more like a silent killer. I just kind of let the game speak for itself.
More than a building, it's also more than its programming. The King Center, by proximity, is also a place for a lot of the city's unsheltered population, at least in the park. Ms. D says they used to open up the center for some of the guys to shower, but there were real safety concerns with some of the untreated mental health issues. She says she'll still open up the center at times, but only when there are no kids present. She wasn't always like this, she says. Certain events have changed her, softened her. Like one winter morning, she's coming into work, and she sees a man behind the building.
He had his little blanket and stuff. He was laying on the vent. And so I went over to him. I was like, you know, you really can't lay there. And he knew my name. So he was like, well, Ms. D, this is the safest place for me to be because it's the warmest place. And I ended up sitting down, striking up a conversation with him. And during that conversation, I found out he had a college degree. And he was extremely intelligent. He just had the mental health issues. And even during the conversation, I could see the issues he had, but they did not supersede the intelligent conversation that I had with this man. And by the time I finished, I mean, I let him in the building, and there was nobody else here. But by the time he left me that morning and stuff, I didn't even work the rest of the day. I was so emotional, and I'm trying not to get the way again, but I was so emotional, taken back, because we all have prejudgments of people. You know, we assume that because somebody is homeless, they're uneducated or they don't want to do better or they chose to be in that position that they're in.
A lot of people jumped to prejudgments a few months ago when 5 Columbus police shot and killed Samuel Sharp Jr. Ms. D knew Sam and his loyal dog Isis. And she says he was nothing like he was portrayed.
He was a different kind of man because he was like a gentle warrior. He, too, you could see some of the issues that he was having, but he was always talking about the better man. He would not talk about what he was experiencing that day or that he lived in a tent. He never talked about any things. He always talked about the betterment of men. And I was just like, that is the last thing that would be on a person's mind that has a house and a shower and stuff. But he always talked about what we could do to better men.
The King Center, it is the heartbeat of the community. Anything that's needed, even if families come in here indigent, you know, there is a program here that will help them or refer them to someone that can help them immediately.
It's true. There are wraparound services for so many different people in situations here. But I also heard about how things have changed, how kids don't show up like they used to. How the park used to be. More sports teams, more staff, more kids playing outside. Symphony said it's not that the neighborhood changed, although it has, but it's the center.
And when you know this area, oh, the kids are here, they just don't feel the same agency and ownership of this place that maybe like my generation did.
What do you think has changed?
It is an all-around systems failure that we are experiencing across the city.
By systems failure, she means parents are working harder than ever to provide, and some people are just trying to survive. And funding from state and local budgets has also slowed. Do more with less is the motto we've heard.
The communities that have the less crime are the ones that have the most resources. And when we began to consider the dignity of Black folks in this city, then we won't have to fight for to eliminate food deserts.
Or struggle to provide safe and affordable housing, or properly fund our schools and community centers.
There are always these conversations about Kia boys and violence and this uptick and da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, we're not making any investments. There's an African proverb that says, young people will burn the village down in order to feel its warmth. because we are not being intentional about creating spaces and opportunities and just wrapping our arms around the young people, the oppressed people, you get what you get.
My heart struggles because if we were not here or we stopped doing the things that we do, I'm not saying that people couldn't get it elsewhere, but it would be more of a struggle for them to get the things that they get from the King Center. I'm 67, I'm ready to not do anything, but I can't because I always think about Sam Sharp. I always think about that young man on my vent. I always think about that boy who died on my floor. I always think about the least man that we're supposed to be thinking of. And if I can't be assured that somebody's going to pick up that ball, then I'm going to keep doing it.
That piece was produced by Jimmy Gutierrez. He spoke with Symphony Swan Zawadi, Dee McCollum, Ernie Haynes, Charles Dupree, and David Powell. If you've ever waited for a movie at the Oriental Theater, you may have found yourself in the underground city for a game of pool, bowling, or Dance Dance Revolution. We'll learn about the history of Landmark Lanes next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Before we wrap up today's show, we bring you an appreciation for a Milwaukee institution, Landmark Lanes. When it was first created in 1927, it would have been hard to imagine how the East Side would evolve in the coming decades. Landmark was originally a part of the Oriental Theater and Oriental Drugs, eventually becoming the underground city that generations of Milwaukeeans have come to know. As a longtime East Sider, Milwaukee Records' Matt Wild is a regular visitor to Landmark, so I met up with him there to learn about this East Side institution. Matt Wild, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Well, thank you for having me, and it's I never really needed an excuse to come here, but I'm happy to be here right now.
This is a place you actually end up going a fair amount, right? Your daughter likes it?
It really is, yeah. I live fairly close to here, so I find myself these days spending a fair amount of time here at the Landmark on the East Side with my 8-year-old daughter. And we go bowling, we play video games, and we just hang out. And yeah, we're here at least once a week, sometimes 2 times a week. So it's a hangout.
Now, for people who have never been to Landmark Lanes, and I admit there are probably few, but how would you describe it?
Well, I think it's interesting. In the last few years, there's been such a kind of a push for these so-called like activity bars. That's been a thing in the last 5, 6, 7 years. The thinking is people just don't want to go out anymore and sit and drink. They want to go out and do something else, whether that's throw axes or paint or play board games or whatever it is. And so there's been a lot of these kind of activity bars popping up in Milwaukee in the last few years. And they're great, but I find it funny because the Landmark in many ways is kind of like Milwaukee's original activity bar. It's been here obviously 95 years, and it's not just a bar. I mean, it's not even just one bar, it's 3 bars. It's not even 3 bars, it's 3 bars and a full bowling alley. It's a full bowling alley and an arcade. And of course you have all the, you know, foosball and darts and all the bar games like that. And on top of that, you have comedy, live comedy here from time to time, and you have live music from time to time. So it's just this kind of entertainment center. It's an activity bar before there were activity bars. So it's called the Underground City. It's definitely underground. It's a rather large basement facility down here, and when you kind of walk down the steps, it's like you're walking into a whole new world.
I think that might be one of the oddest things about Landmark. When you're walking past, it's you know, like an entrance like any that you might see into a storefront, but the storefront in this case looks pretty small. It's really just kind of a doorway between a couple other storefronts. And then you walk down, and it is a full bowling alley. But, I mean, where we're sitting right now, it is just one of the bars. There are multiple bars down here. There's a number of pool tables. It's kind of like, I don't know, six places in one.
Yeah, I think Underground City is very apt, and they have that, you know, just a big sign that says this as you're walking down the steps. And you're right, it's like, you know, just one of these bars, the one we're in right now, I guess, is the Moon Room. And there's the front bar and the back bar, and each on their own would be a perfectly serviceable, perfectly lovely little neighborhood bar. But they're all piled on, you know, next to each other, and there's a kind of the bowling alley and the arcade, and it's all down here, and it's all kind of hidden, and I kind of like that. It's very apt. I think the Landmark is a place where I think a lot of people of a certain age have a lot of memories of this place, that coming here and kind of the heyday of like the 90s, 80s, 90s, maybe into the early aughts. And it's kind of a place that I think a lot of folks, as they get a little older, they kind of forget about it. And if I could be a Landmark advocate here, I would be here to say that it's still here. I don't think it's going anywhere anytime soon. It's still here. It's still largely the same place that a lot of folks remember. They've been doing a little spiffing up here and there. There's a new marquee outside. There's been, you know, some nice new paint jobs in here. For folks, again, of a certain age who remember this place during the time when we could smoke in bars, it does not smell like that anymore. I think that's one of the most enduring memories of the Landmark for certain people. Just remembering this place when you could smoke and having it packed wall to wall, all three bars, and every single person smoking all night long, and just a haze in here. And I was certainly in on kind of the latter years of that, and it was one of those things where you would just, you could be here an hour, make one or two beers, and you'd have to burn your clothes at the end of the night. I mean, they would just smell so bad. And so those days, thankfully, are long gone. It's not like that anymore. But in so many other ways, it's the Landmark you've always known and loved.
So you mentioned, of course, kind of the heydays of Landmark, but we're talking about actually a space that is, 95 years old. What is some of the history of this space?
Well, as 95 years would suggest, it kind of opened more or less in 1927. It was tied in with the Oriental Theater, which is right next door, of course. And before that, it was like a horse and mule and streetcar barn. So in 27, it kind of became a bar. And in 1972, I believe, it kind of became more or less the bar that we know now, the Oriental Lanes and Theater. And they changed it at that point into Oriental Landmark Lanes. That was kind of, you know, where things were for decades after that. And, you know, even if you look on the Landmark's website, it's funny, they do refer to the like 80s and 90s as their heyday, like just people down here packed wall to wall. It's changed hands in the last decade or so, but it's really remained the same. So it's been this kind of constant thing for so many decades. So it's the real deal. It's just kind of been this thing forever.
There's a brand new sign outside. What I found interesting about this brand new sign, looking at both the sign they replaced and the sign underneath it, remarkably little has changed.
That's right, yeah. You know, people are scared of change. People don't want change. But, you know, looking at it, it was like, sure, this new sign could have been made in the 70s or 80s. It's retro without being, I think, obnoxiously retro. So I think it's very fitting.
A continuation of an institution on the east side.
Absolutely. And that's what this place, I think, really is. And like I was saying before, it's a place that I think a lot of people have fond memories of when they lived on the east side, and maybe in the years since they've moved on to other neighborhoods, they've moved out to Bayview or even farther flung than that. Some have gone way out to the suburbs, but the east side, I moved here way back in 1996. I've been here ever since. I've never left the east side. I've kind of just bounced around in a small radius from apartment building to apartment building. And it's really reassuring that this place and this neighborhood kind of sure has seen some change, but the Landmark is still here. And it's it's something that, you know, people need to be reminded of sometimes. Maybe they haven't been to the side of town in a long time, and I am here to say that welcome back to the East Side. It's there's a lot of things that are different, but one thing that is not different is the landmark, and it's, you know, in my view, lovelier than ever.
Well, Matt, thank you so much for joining me here at Landmark.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Matt Wild is a co-founder of Milwaukee Record and a longtime fan of Landmark Lanes. We spoke in 2022 when the bar was celebrating 95 years. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn about accidental shootings among children in Wisconsin and how parents responsible for gun access can be charged differently depending on where they live. That's tomorrow at noon right here on Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.